Well, after taking a day off yesterday so those folks up in Washington could conduct the impeachment hearing, we're back with you today on Political Rewind, and really glad to be back on the air because there's so much to talk about in politics here in Georgia, as well as everything that's going on up in Washington. I'm Bill Nygut. A couple of quick notes before I introduce the panel and we start our conversation for today. A reminder that as of January 6th, Monday, January 6th, we are going to be on the air 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. A lot of you listen to the show have been saying to us for quite some time you want to hear us every day, which is very gratifying to all of us who work on the show. But it was also, we used to try to figure out how to explain, well, we're on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, not on Thursday and back on Friday, and I won't even bother with the way in which that got grandfathered in, but we're not going to have to answer that question starting on Monday, January 6th. So I hope you'll be with us then. And of course, as Tom Faust reminds me all the time, my job, among other things, is to tell people if you can't be near your radio at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you can subscribe to our podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. And if you want to watch the show at your leisure, you can go to the GPB news page on Facebook. Right now we're on Facebook Live, but those shows are archived so that you can watch them whenever you feel like it. Okay, enough of the announcements. Tamar Hallerman, AJC reporter, fresh from Washington, now in Atlanta, settled in, set to do your work from out of here, out of the fray up there. Welcome to the show. Here you are in the studio.
Thank you. First week in Atlanta.
Tell everybody what kind of work you're going to be doing for the AJC here.
Sure. I'm describing it to people as middle distance running. Like if you're investigative reporters, you're long distance runner. If in D.C. where I was dealing with a lot of breaking news, I was a sprinter. Now I'm taking the middle distance approach. I'm going to try and step back from the day-to-day news and kind of try at least to do smarter stories about all these actions happening on the federal and state level, what it means for Georgians' lives. I'm also going to be covering stuff like gender, women in the workplace, LGBT, religious liberty, water wars still. So plenty of new and old things.
It's interesting to hear you say that, among other things, you'll be looking at women's issues because the New York Times, the Washington Post, they've really now got they have an editor in each of those papers assigned specifically to ferret out and to do more in-depth reporting on just that, women's issues.
Yeah, and it's something that's new to me. The last 10 years, I've been really focused on Congress and legislation and politics, always viewing it through that lens, and I'm excited to, all of that obviously is infused in this new coverage area, but it'll be cool to do it with a new angle.
Well, we're glad that you're going to be with us when you are here in the studio. So welcome to Atlanta tomorrow. Hallerman. Joel Alvarado is with us in the studio today. Joel is, the vice president?
Executive vice president
of Ohio River South. You're a consulting firm. You do government relations work. You also do political campaigns.
Correct.
Your partner, Howard Franklin, who is a frequent panelist on the show, too.
Absolutely.
Remind us of the campaigns that you're looking at working on this cycle.
Well, one definitely is Teresa Tomlinson working on that one. And there are some others that are emerging. You know, this is sort of the calm before the storm.
Yeah.
So we're sort of putting all the opportunities on the table and see which ones makes the most sense because we have a conscience in our organization, so we don't want to just support somebody who we don't believe in. We want to make sure we have the right person who has the right message and right vision, and then we put all our blood, sweat, and tears behind that person to ensure they get success.
Well, it's good to have you here, Joel. You talk about Teresa Tomlinson. I noticed today Republican operatives who have been peppering all of us in the media with releases about the awful people running for the Democratic nominations for various positions have really been on Tomlinson today. They say all the Democratic candidates for Senate are pro-impeachment and are awful people because of it, but especially Teresa Tomlinson has really thrown her weight behind impeachment. So Republicans must see her as something of a threat?
If they're not talking about you, you must not be doing something right.
Right. Martha Zoller is with us from the studios of WDUN in Gainesville, where she does her daily talk show, a very, very popular show up that way. Martha, we introduce you always as someone who's been on both sides of the fence. You have worked in politics. You've worked for David Perdue. You ran for Congress yourself. You worked for a while early in the Kemp administration. But now you're back to radio. And aren't you glad you are?
I am. And I have to tell you, I had to chuckle when you were saying the calm before the storm.
Yeah.
Because it hasn't been very calm. But I love this. You know, I mean, this is, you know, I've loved politics since I was a kid, discussing it around the dinner table with my family. And I still love it today.
All right. Well, good. Because we're going to talk a lot about it today. District Court Judge Steve Jones has been is sitting on the case brought by Stacey Abrams' organization, challenging some aspects of the voting, the election system in Georgia. We know there's a big federal case that slowly making its way through court, that Fair Fight Action is trying to move forward. Steve Jones has been sitting on that case. Tamar, one of the things that Fair Fight Action had asked of the court is that they be allowed to interview Governor Kemp about various aspects of what they see as efforts to suppress the vote. Things like exact match, things like purging the voter rolls, and other aspects of what Fair Fight Action is concerned about. Jones this morning essentially said most of those things. He kind of took this from a 10,000-foot level and said, look, when a plaintiff comes here and wants to talk to someone of a governor's statue, whoever it may be, there has to be compelling reason why that person's time should be taken up by dealing with the issues that the plaintiff wants to deal with. In this case, we think that there are other people who the plaintiffs can talk to about things like exact match, which started before Kemp, voter purges, that sort of thing. But the one thing they said was that the governor should have to come in and answer 2 hours of questions about a statement that he made about voters. I'll read the statement, then I'll turn it over to you, and then everybody can jump in. Yeah, we can't really play it because the audio isn't good enough. But Better Georgia, a Democratic-leaning organization, captured these comments by Secretary of State Brian Kemp back in 2014. He was talking to a group of Gwinnett County Republicans, and among other things, he said this: in closing, I just wanted to tell you real quick, after we get through this runoff, you know, the Democrats are working hard, and all these stories about them, you know, registering all these minority voters that are out there and others that are sitting on the sidelines, if they can do that, they can win these elections in November. Fair Fight Action believes the governor should have to answer what he meant by those comments, and the judge agreed with him.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's the sort of thing, I guess you can look at it from any number of ways. It depends on how you want to interpret those remarks. You know, if you're a Republican, you can say, oh, but he's using this as a rallying cry to say, okay, Republicans, we need to step up what we're doing. If you're a Democrat, you can frame this as a very sinister way. See, he's going to go after us and our voters.
Yeah. Martha, you jump in because you pointed out that there's a larger context to these remarks.
Well, absolutely. And Jim Galloway, who's on this program all the time and has been covering Georgia politics for, you know, a very long time, wrote an article about this in 2014. And he gave the second part of that statement, which was, well, we've got to do the exact same thing. I would encourage all of you, if you have an Android or an Apple device, download that app and make it your goal to register one new Republican voter. So, you know, if you take the entire statement in context, what it's really saying is, it is a rallying cry. It's like, wow, they're way ahead of us. And as a person that's been involved in Republican politics for the last probably 10 years, the biggest complaint we've had at Republican meetings is we do a lousy job of registering voters. We haven't had an actual voter registration drive in Georgia in 20 years for Republicans. And it's been something that if you're inside Republican politics, you've been saying, we're doing a lousy job at this and we need to do a better job.
So, you know, given all that, Joel, you've got to say that the judge made a very, very narrow ruling. He believed that only the governor could speak to what he meant when he was Secretary of State and said that those comments. And I'm sure he'll go into court and do exactly what Martha did, say there was a larger context. But even though it's very narrowly defined now in terms of what he's going to testify to, the very fact that a governor is being called in to answer questions in a deposition, I assume, on this is somewhat dramatic. Governors don't get called in very often to answer in lawsuits like this.
I would say that a couple of things. One is I respect the judge in regarding his handling of this. I think he's very respectful of the office, and I do appreciate that because I'm a Georgian like everyone else, and I respect the position of governor. Two, I think that it highlights the importance of this case, that it warrants having the governor coming for 2 hours to be deposed to get clarity regarding what he said. So I don't think we should discount that. And then the third thing, too, I like to believe that what Fair Fight, and I don't work with them on this issue, of course, but I think they're looking at intentionality and that sort of cause and effect, in that they look at the language that was uttered by then Secretary of State Kemp, and they look at some of the actions that have taken place in various election cycles, and they say, it seems that people of color are the ones that are most impacted by decisions that are being made in the Secretary of State's office, either at the local level or at the state level. And then this language that pops up here in a very partisan event. And so they want to see if there's a correlation. I'm not saying there is or isn't, but I'm saying that I can understand why they want to further examine this language, because all that has happened in various election cycles to people of color while trying to vote.
Martha, the judge did give the Fair Fight Action folks just a little bit more room in their questioning. He wrote that Kemp can also be asked to provide information about whether state election officials investigated and resolved complaints quickly. And that can become that really does speak to one of the more important aspects of the case, the Fair Fight Action folks would say, and that's things like absentee voters not getting their votes, not having their votes accepted, people who showed up at the polls to vote and were told they weren't registered. I mean, that does give them a little more leeway to address some of the larger questions in their suit, right?
I mean, I think it does, but I think that if you look at the entire record, and I'm sure they will at some point in time, of voter turnout and registration throughout not just Kemp, but Handel and those that have been in Secretary of State positions for the last 10 years or so, we have really seen a dramatic increase across the board of people registered to vote and going out to vote. And I think that's a great thing, okay? And I'm willing to bet, I haven't been to a Democratic Party meeting in a really long time, I probably should, but I'm willing to bet there's kind of language like that going on in those meetings too, saying that you can't let those other folks catch up with us, and I don't know what terminology they use to describe those other folks, okay? But you can't let those folks catch up with us. We've got the momentum. We're going to get out there. Look, party meetings are kind of, you know, rah-rah meetings.
Sure, they're rallying cries.
Yeah. The problem is whether it's a Republican meeting or a Democrat meeting, although I think the Democrats are probably doing a better job getting people to come to their meetings right now, it's hard to get people in general to come to meetings. And so that's another issue for another day to talk about, is what is the structure that's going to really get people to the polls. And I think that Fair Fight Georgia and on the left and other groups on the right are trying to figure that out now.
So Martha, I think everything you just said makes a lot of sense. I am going to call you out very quickly. I think I should put a buzzer in the studio for every time a conservative member of the panel talks about the Democrat Party instead of the Democratic Party. Because I guarantee you, there will be more tweets and Facebook Live posts about your calling it the Democrat Party.
Yeah, that was unintentional, but I get those tweets myself. Yes. Thank you.
So tomorrow we'll see. I mean, it's very hard to see just how this – I mean, clearly the judge is going to have to look at all this, but we're moving ahead with the 2020 election. The Georgia legislature this last session did make some changes to election laws to address some of the concerns that have been raised. So it's going to be interesting to see how much traction this case really gets in the months ahead.
Exactly. And with all this noise, with impeachment and with primaries and the presidential primaries, it'll be hard. But seeing a sitting governor deposed
Interesting.
Breakthrough.
Joel? I would say to that very quickly, you know, while I don't want to see any governor's time taken up a lot with this kind of stuff, I do think it's very important that when necessary, even governors can be called in and ask questions about things. And I don't think that's a bad thing. And Steve Jones is a guy I know very well. He served as the head of the UGA Alumni Association board when I was a board member there. So I know him very well. I trust him, and he has great integrity. So I'm not saying he's never made a mistake, and I'm not going to judge this yet. But he's a guy I trust, so I'm willing to sit back and see what happens.
Okay, Joe. Well, I agree with Martha as well. I think no elected official is above our legal system, and so I think it's important that if you're called upon, you should speak, and if it needs to be deposed. But what I wanted to say is that in the midst of all this going on, then we have the integration of the new voting machines on top of that. So at 2020, when we have like a perfect storm in Georgia with two Senate races and up and down ballots, up and down the ballot, be competitive races in a presidential race. If somebody wanted to write a paper, this is the perfect time to do so on this matter, because it's so much dynamism going on and there's so many variables in place that could really impact key political outcomes.
And the presidential primary in Georgia is barreling down on us, and especially on election officials tomorrow. We're talking about March 24th, getting all the machines in place, dealing with the registration issues that have been raised. And, I mean, Joel's right. We have got we're going to be following a pretty interesting story in the months ahead.
Yeah, and that's not the only race. I mean, we have that's only for the presidential primaries.
Right.
And we've got the state-level ones in May, runoffs, Senate races.
Can't wait. That's why we're going to be on 5 days a week.
Absolutely.
One other quick thing, and maybe we'll do a little crowdsourcing here. I tried before going on the air to see if I could find a previous example of a governor of Georgia being called to give a deposition in a lawsuit like this. And someone suggested that maybe Governor Barnes had to do it when the districts that they drew in 2000 went to court. But I don't recall that's the case. So maybe we'll turn it over to our listeners. They're a smart group, Joel. See if they can recall a time when a Georgia governor has been asked to be involved or has been ordered, essentially, to be involved in a case like this. All right, let's move on. Martha, Chris Ray, a guy who had a very comfortable, well-paying job as a private attorney here in Atlanta. He heard the call of duty when President Trump asked him to step in as head of the FBI. Chris Ray has managed, Martha, to keep a pretty low profile, except for a couple of very notable exceptions, one of them being the last 24 hours or so in the aftermath of the Inspector General's release of the report on how the FBI, how the Justice Department, what the predicates were for beginning their investigation of whether the Trump campaign was doing, it was illegally talking to Russians. And Chris Ray couldn't help after the IG said, I think for the most part, well, Martha, you tell other people, I'm talking too much. You can characterize the IG's report, which essentially was they made mistakes, but it isn't what Trump said it was.
Well, I think look, we're going to be debating this. I do have a real problem with they've been talking about what's in the report before it came out. It came out yesterday, and now everybody's an expert on it, right? I'm certainly not an expert on it. I've reviewed it, but I can't tell. I want to trust what's in a report like that because I want to trust my institutions like that. But Chris Ray has stepped in it. I mean, he got a response from the president. We're going to just have to see what happens there.
So the Inspector General reported that there were serious mistakes made, particularly in the way in which the FISA warrants were asked for, and that they and Chris Ray did say when he but also the IG said, but there was no intent, political intent on the part of anyone in justice to go after President Trump's campaign or then candidate Trump's campaign to spy on the campaign. He absolved the responsibility for that part of it. Chris Wray, in an interview with ABC News about all this, said this.
Well, I think it's important for the American people to know that when the FBI opens an investigation, it does so with proper predication, with proper authorization, based on the law and the facts and nothing else. And I think it's important that the Inspector General found that in this particular instance, the investigation was opened with appropriate predication and authorization. The Inspector General did not find political bias or improper motivations impacting the opening of the investigation or the decision to use certain investigative tools during the investigations.
Is the FBI, was it part of some deep state?
Well, I think that's the kind of label that is a disservice to the 37,000 men and women who work at the FBI who I think tackle their jobs with professionalism, with rigor, with objectivity, and with courage. So that's not a term I would ever use to describe our workforce, and I think it's an affront to them.
Joel, the question about the deep state, of course, a direct reflection of what President Trump has said about much of the intelligence community. And Chris Wray says, don't talk about our people that way. You're doing them a disservice. They're people of great integrity.
Well, I appreciate the director stepping up and defending his people. There are others who in the administration who have not done that. And let me just say this, Bill. As a person who's worked most of his life in public service, in local government, I wonder about the morale of federal employees, and I wonder about the erosion of objectivity and independence of public servants, where their product is supposed to be data-driven based on the facts. It's about service. It's not about politics. It's not about serving politics. It's about serving people. And I'm concerned because the federal government plays such a major role in our lives. And if you have these individuals who are fearful of making a decision because they believe it doesn't align with the politics of the president, and that if they and if it doesn't, that they can be vilified and put in public and brought to the public and be demonized and be charged with being a part of a deep state. How do we expect for our public servants who are doing phenomenal work for us day in and day out to be able to conduct the work they need on our behalf?
That was certainly tomorrow what Chris Wray had in mind when he made his remarks to ABC News. The president had a different idea. He tweeted this morning this. I don't know what report current director, I thought it was interesting, current director of the FBI, Christopher Wray, was reading, but it sure wasn't the one given to me. With that kind of attitude, he will never be able to fix the FBI, which is badly broken despite having some of the greatest men and women working there.
And I mean, that's an ominous sign for Chris Wray's future. You know, on the one hand, he was appointed for 10 years with the idea that, you know, this kind of gets him out of the day-to-day politics. A 10-year term would stretch across two administrations, even if you have someone serving for 8 years. But at the same time, Trump didn't hesitate to fire Jim Comey or to really, you know, trash his successor, Andrew McCabe, in the press as well. So, you know, that created a lot of problems for him, obviously, after he fired Comey. And you know, he's still dealing with the implications of that now. A lot of that led to the Mueller stuff, but you know, he hasn't been afraid in the past, and maybe this is a bad sign for Chris Wray.
Martha, I want you to feel free to weigh in on any aspect of this as you want to, but I'd also like to add this, if I may. This isn't the first time that Chris Wray has found himself somewhat at odds with the president. Back when the president of the United States said that he thought accepting help from he would certainly listen if a foreign government came to him with dirt on an opponent. He thought it was important to listen to that person. At the time, Chris Wray said he thought that was a mistake. He said that publicly. And we have learned subsequently, or we believe we've learned, that he considered whether he ought to resign in the aftermath of that incident. So go ahead, Martha.
Well, I mean, and that does not surprise me that he would consider that, because you have to, even though the FBI director has a 10-year term, regardless of who's elected president, you have to consider whether you're going to be able to, in some way, do the support the policy of the president, of the current president, because he's ultimately, you know, the final word. He's the person that can fire you. He's who you report to. I think the challenge that you have with all of these is that there was clearly, while I believe most of the people that work for the FBI are great folks, I know a lot of people that work for the FBI, there were some people that caused some great damage to the FBI. I mean, I think the way Comey handled things at the end with these memos that he was keeping in different places and leaking to the press and doing that sort of thing, it's great for us in the press, but I don't think it's the way to do business in the FBI, because you have to have a certain level of trust in intelligence agencies that you don't have to know everything they're doing. You don't want to know everything they're doing, because you have to trust that they're working at the best interest of our country. And then the text messages were very problematic to me, of the couple that were involved in an affair, which, you know, in today's workplace, you know, that's a problem.
Yeah, there's no – I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish
no,
your
but
statement.
That's my concern there, is that there were people that were a worm in the FBI that were – seemed to be opposed to Trump because of him being Trump and not because of anything that he did.
You know what? So, Joel – Martha makes a point. Mm-hmm. There are always these little tidbits here and there that do tend to keep this from being as clean. Many of the things we're dealing with right now in terms of Democratic and Republican arguments back and forth have just a kernel of something that raises questions. Strozak and Page, their communications back and forth certainly seemed unseemly in many ways. And of course, Trump has seized upon that. But the IG looked at that, as well as the rest of this investigation of Russian involvement with the Trump campaign, and he said there was no effort to politicize. But that doesn't take away that little cloud hanging over all this for the people who want something to grab hold of.
Right. And I will say this. We are fallible people who operate in fallible organizations, right? We no organization is perfect, right? But I would say that my concern is this idea that there's a cabal working together in a deep state. And for all of you listening, I'm doing air quotes, in a deep state, and that they're somehow plotting the demise of Donald Trump. That's really problematic, because I used the word before, intentionality. That means people are coming together for the purpose of destroying him. And there's been no proof of that. And this IG report saying that there was no political bias whatsoever.
Well, okay, we've got to get to a break. Tomorrow I'm going to get – but we're not going to – guys, if you don't mind holding off, I don't want to take a break until we've heard what William Barr just said a little while ago. The Attorney General just weighed in an exclusive interview with Pete Williams at NBC News. It just broke shortly before we went on the air. And listen to how Barr interprets the IG's report and what he thinks about that report.
I think probably from a civil liberties standpoint, the greatest danger to our free system is that the incumbent government use the apparatus of the state, principally the law enforcement agencies and the intelligence agencies, both to spy on political opponents, but also to use them in a way that could affect the outcome of the election. As far as I'm aware, this is the first time in history that this has been done to a presidential campaign, the use of these counterintelligence techniques against a presidential campaign.
Tamara?
Yeah, I mean, it shows the tough position that especially Chris Wray has been put in all this. You know, Bill Barr is his boss. Yeah. He's the one he has to directly report to. And it's rare that you see such a fissure between those two. Usually it's between the president and the Justice Department. And it shows the tough spot that he's in, because not only is he tasked with kind of rebuilding morale within the agency after Jim Comey, after Andrew McCabe, after all these text messages being leaked publicly, but you also have to rebuild trust in the eyes of the public. And you have a president who will go on Twitter and, you know, say all sorts of things about you. And it's a tough job.
Yeah. And we'll see how it plays out in the days ahead. But you're exactly right. And despite the fact that many people thought this IG's report, and certainly Chris Wray has already said, I'm embracing the problems the report revealed, and we're going to fix them, you would have hoped that maybe this IG's report would put a period on all of this concern about whether the Trump campaign was in fact the victim of political spying or not. That is not the case. We'll probably be talking about this story for weeks and weeks to come. Right now, though, let's take our first break of the show. We'll be back in just a minute.
During this season of giving, we're counting on you to help GPB finish 2019 strong and prepare to make the most of what 2020 will bring, particularly with the next presidential election on the horizon. Make your tax-deductible year-end gift now at gpb.org or call 800-222-4788, and your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar thanks to Jane Hyatt at the Hyatt Fund, Community Foundation of Mississippi. Thank you.
When Atlanta hosted the 1996 Olympics, a terrorist struck.
There was an explosive device. It does not
work. In the rush for justice, the wrong man was presumed guilty.
You know my name, but you do not really know who I am.
Mistaken, the real story of Richard Jewell follows his descent from hero to villain in the court of public opinion. Join us for this special broadcast from On Second Thought, Friday morning at 9 on GPB, or stream it from the On Second Thought podcast feed.
I have to tell you, I have been sort of watching Virginia Prescott and her team work on this Richard Jewell show that they're putting together, and it's really going to be interesting. I'm looking forward to hearing it on Friday morning and hope all of you will be tuning in as well. Before we get back to our topics for the day, let me remind you all, we're looking for people who want to be on the radio. People who want to join our citizen panel, which I hope we're going to do by the end of January, and you can nominate yourself. You can be just like the people who wanted to apply for Johnny Isaacson's Senate job. You can call our special hotline number, 404-685-2426. Tell us your name. Give us your phone number, obviously. Tell us where, what part of the state you live in. Let us know, are you a Trump supporter? Are you anti-Trump, Democrat, Republican? And then very briefly tell us why you would be a good person to be part of our citizen panel. And please do it all in a minute or less, because about a minute in, Sam's going to cut it off and not listen to the rest of what you have to say. So 404-685-2426. We've already had an awful lot of people who want to be part of that show, so we're only going to do this for a few more days. So if you're interested, I think you should get your voicemail to us as soon as possible. Okay. Tamar Hallerman. So we're now almost a week after the announcement that Brian Kemp's putting Kelly Loeffler into the United States Senate. She'll be there in Johnny Isaacson's seat starting in January and then stand for election, the special election in November. And your colleagues and you over at the AJC have been reporting on this. The Jolt has had a lot of information. There have been stories in the newspaper itself. She's now starting to make her move. She's starting to get out there talking to political insiders. Give us a little sense of what Kelly Loeffler is doing right now about this effort.
Yeah, well, we've had the one public event now with the governor last week where he introduced her to the press and to the state as a whole as you know, his designate for the Senate seat. And we saw her really try and talk about how she's a good conservative. And that was a big concern. You saw a lot of conservatives who were very concerned. They wanted Doug Collins in for that seat. And so really questioned her credentials. They talked about the WNBA, how they've done events in the past with Planned Parenthood, kind of framing her as kind of a closet liberal or a rhino or
whatever.
They threw
a lot of shade on Grady Hospital,
sure,
saying it's a place that trains abortion,
sure,
doctors.
So you saw her try and assuage all that criticism and frame herself as not only a Kemp conservative, but a Trump conservative as well. She really highlighted her support for the president. She talked about a lot of Kemp's initiatives, anti-gang sorts of things, her support for, tightening immigration rules, that sort of thing. So that's what we've seen from her so far. We're waiting to do interviews with her and that sort of thing. And we'll see in the weeks ahead. She still has to hire a staff and get all of that assembled. And, we don't know much about her financial situation. She's going to have to start filing forms with the Senate as well. So that'll come soon, and we don't know much about the work she's going to be doing on the Hill yet.
Martha, I thought one of the most important things we learned is that one of the calls that Loeffler made was to Virginia Galloway, who you know, I'm sure. And by the way,
yes,
Martha, I don't want you to have a sore loser attitude when you talk
no,
about this.
No.
Because we all know you put your name in there, and you would have been great. But so She talked to Virginia Galloway, Ralph Reed's Faith and Freedom Coalition representative here in Georgia, and Galloway had nice things to say about her. That's an important sign for Loeffler, isn't it?
No, I think it is, too. And I've had a couple of conversations with her also. I think that it'll be, you know, it'll be interesting to see how all of this plays out. And, you know, it's a hit the ground running, but it's also you don't want to have any missteps, you know, initially when you get started. So you sort of have this period of time between now and the end of the year, you know, where she'll be getting her campaign team together. And I would watch that very closely about who ends up being in the campaign team. You know, are they Kemp people? Or are they Purdue people? Are they a mixture of the two? I think it'll be very interesting to see from a political standpoint, and we're Political Rewind, how that all plays out, because that will kind of set up some of the interesting ways we're going to look at this in 2020.
And she's really going to have to start her political operation completely in tandem, or even have that almost trump the official office kind of side of her duties. What's great about being a senator is you're only running for re-election every 6 years. She only gets 11 months in the Senate before she has to go through all of this.
And then 2 years and she'll have to do it again if she wins.
Exactly. Yeah. So a very defensive posture she's going to have to start. And she already knows, you know, you're seeing Democrats start staffing up. You know, the party hired a spokesman just on this race to be talking about it. So she's going to be under the microscope in a way that maybe only Lucy McBath understands right now.
That's fascinating to compare to that. Martha, is Kelly Loeffler conservative enough for Republicans in Georgia to decide to support her, to stop worrying about Doug Collins or other people that they are conservative enough?
And I think so, and I'll tell you why. One of the things that, you know, I'm working on my master's degree right now, and my thesis is on women's electoral success in the Republican Party. And that's one of the things I'm studying and working on. And if you take a look at this situation that we find ourselves in as Republicans, is not about necessarily flipping Democrats. This is about getting back Republicans and independents that we have lost in the last two elections. And if you look at that area, that arc of the state, okay, that is the area that voted for Hillary Clinton, then voted for Stacey Abrams, voted for Karen Handel in the special, who's a Republican, and then voted for Lucy McBath. They have no problem voting for women. They voted for women four times now, but we've got to get them back. And Kelly Loeffler is the kind of Republican, the conservative Republican, that's going to be able to get those people back on board and be able to win elections.
Joe?
Well, the way I look at it, too, and I agree with what Martha said, is that my concern is this litmus test, this are you conservative enough? Are you progressive enough? And then what happens is that you shrink the spectrum, where it's just a very finite, you know, space for people to claim being conservative or Democrat. And that's really problematic because, you know, I'm old enough to know politics in a time where, you know, when you talked about Democrat, it ran the full ideological gamut.
Well, know? Republicans too.
Absolutely, absolutely. but there's something important about that because it's you're making people silent who have a voice in the conversation, and that's really problematic. Where people say, "I have it's an either or, it's a binary choice," and you're not offering me enough of space where I can truly identify who I am and speak my truth politically. That's problematic, and I think that's going to be counterintuitive in the long run for any party who wants to ensure that they have enough people supporting their vision.
Well, the question that we have asked on this show, and I imagine we'll continue asking it, is why, Tamar, people believe, and Martha really referred to it, and I know she isn't this reductionist, but I'll let you talk about it, and she can answer then. Just because you're a woman doesn't mean women are going to vote for you if your issues are wrong.
Sure, and just because she's from the Atlanta suburbs doesn't mean that suburban women are going to vote for her either. And the question is how she threads the needle, right? Because she has two groups she really needs to appeal to right now. She has to win over the Republican base that's very skeptical of her right now and is more inclined to back somebody like Doug Collins. Collins, you know, who could challenge her, jump into this jungle primary. She also has to woo these suburban Republican women, just like Martha was talking about, who were really wooed by people like Stacey Abrams talking about things like Medicaid expansion and education and that sort of thing. So it's going to be a really tough line or, you know, needle to thread. And it'll be interesting to see what issues she really focuses on once she gets to the Senate in order to do that.
Martha, I want to change the subject just briefly. I mean, still Loeffler, but a different aspect of Loeffler. You know, when her name was announced last week, I immediately started thinking of her first and foremost as a candidate, which is certainly what she will be. But even more quickly than that, she has to become a member of the United States Senate and begin to deal with what it means to be in the Senate, deal with issues in the Senate. And so in many ways, that's the first opportunity we're going to get to see her. How does she deal with what's happening on the floor of the Senate? What kind of votes will she take? What issues will even come to the floor for votes?
Impeachment every day.
She's going to deal with impeachment.
That is the number one thing she has in her favor.
That's right.
Okay, because she is going to be the senator. And I would say to anybody, I would advise anybody, you know, that, and I'm sure on the Democrat side, they're giving the same advice. You want to have the minimum number of people as possible in this so-called primary in November, because you could end up with two Democrats or two Republicans going through, and then because there'll probably be a runoff, it's a problem. But there is one person that, you know, we haven't mentioned here too much, and it's Johnny Isaacson and Johnny Isaacson's staff. All of his staff is not going to go away. A certain number of those folks are going to stay. And there's nobody better on staff, because everybody knows that, yes, you're going to be on the floor and she's going to get pluses or minuses based on what she does on the floor. But that constituent services, that being able to keep that Senate office running, being able to handle things that come in, that is something that a lot of people don't put a lot of value in. But I do, having been a person that's done that kind of work. It's important. So she's got three tracks, really, that are really important here. How she's going to get that office up and running and keep constituent services going, what she's going to do on the floor, and then how she's going to put her campaign staff together.
Exactly. And an issue, because it did take Governor Kemp a little while to appoint somebody or announce somebody after Johnny retired or announced his retirement, was that there were some staffers who maybe would have been inclined to work for Loeffler or whoever Kemp appointed, but who got so nervous about waiting, who left and decided to go on to other things. So I am interested to see how many of them jump. But then another thing to mention is going off of Martha said, what issues she really focuses on when impeachment is not in the spotlight. The idea, or at least what I'm reading, is that impeachment hearings will be in the afternoon, which leaves all morning for hearings and that sort of things. Does she pick a signature issue like Karen Handel did on human trafficking, like Lucy McBath is trying to do on VA veterans issues, where you can try and broaden your appeal?
That's really a
good point.
Thank you for that. One other quick thing about that, Tamar, is, you know, Republicans are sort of gleefully talking about the fact that when the trial, if a trial is going to be held, if the House almost inevitably does vote out impeachment articles, that it's going to take some of the Democratic presidential candidates off the campaign trail because they got to sit in the trial in the Senate. Well, if a presumed trial does take place in January, that's still many months before the November election. But Kelly Loeffler's got to start getting up to speed with the campaign, and I'm wondering, to some extent, does the impeachment trial, you know, hamper her a little bit in her efforts to get out there and have a campaign?
Sure. And she has to, you know, get to know Georgia voters, which means spending time here in Georgia. You know, she wasn't really known as much outside of Metro Atlanta. So that will be definitely, you know, certainly a challenge, especially since there is talk about keeping senators in even on Saturdays and stuff to hear this testimony.
Yeah, so they always threaten that tomorrow, don't they?
All right. Hey, I got a threat I've got to put out there. We're going to take another break. Because we have to get it in, and if I don't get it in, Sam and Tom are going to come in here and turn off my microphone. So let's take our final break of the show. We'll be right back with more.
I'm Noelle King. Over the past year, you listened as news broke and developed. You kept up with it all because being informed is important to you. And maybe as the stories changed, you did too. You heard new angles and voices. You understood. You grew. There will be more to learn in the new year, and we'll explore it all together. So please make a year-end gift now, because when we grow, you do too. Donate online at gpb.org or call 800-222-4788.
On the next Fresh Air, Peter Bergen, national security analyst for CNN and author of the new book, Trump and His Generals, The Cost of Chaos. We'll talk about how Trump went from bragging about the generals and his administration to later basically going to war with them. Bergen says now that the generals are no longer in the administration, Trump is surrounded by yes men. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3, right here on GPB and on gpbnews.org.
Martha Zoller, Tamar Hallerman, Joel Alvarado on Political Rewind today. Joel, you wanted to make one quick statement about the people who are now the Republican candidates for the Senate.
Yes. I was just thinking about relatability, that now you have two very wealthy individuals representing the state of Georgia as United States senators. And there's so many challenges that everyday hardworking Georgians are facing. And one of the – so for the senator-elect – well, not a senator-elect, but the incoming senator, she has to figure out a way to create a narrative in the midst of everything else that we talked about to say that I understand you, I'm here to represent you, and I'm here to provide the service that I believe you deserve as Georgians in the United States Senate.
So, Martha, I want to move on from this, but I do want to give you a chance to say something about that. You know, two things, really, from my point of view. One of them is it'd be interesting to see surveys of how much wealth really matters anymore to a lot of voters. I mean, I know Bernie Sanders talks about it a lot, Elizabeth Warren, and we certainly know there's a huge gap and disparity that's one of the biggest problems the country faces between rich and poor. But I'm not sure it plays out in terms of how voters make up their minds about who they vote for.
Well, have you looked at the net worth of United States senators, including the one you just mentioned?
Well,
I mean, it's there. But I will tell you, in the case of both Senator Perdue and Senator Loeffler, or Senator Designate Loeffler, they have these stories of coming from humble beginnings, going to public colleges, you know, having things, you know, so they've got a story of success in America that started from, you know, from humble beginnings.
Yeah,
so
I think you're
right. I don't think people oppose that kind of wealth. I'm with you. I kind of look at wealthy people and go, okay, what did they do to get there and how can I do it?
So I do think Loeffler has a really good personal story to tell.
Yes.
Growing up in rural Illinois, you know, working with animals on the farm, being a big 4-H'er. So it'll be interesting to see how she uses that as she's out there on the campaign trail. Can I go ahead?
For me, the argument I would make is right now to voters that the litmus test matters a lot more. Are you sufficiently conservative?
Yeah.
Are you sufficiently liberal?
Right. Right.
And not only that, but campaigns are so expensive now that to the party bosses who are deciding who to lift up in the party, it certainly helps if you can.
And as much as I hate to say it, Tamar, it is the abortion issue on both sides.
Yes.
That is that litmus test. That is the most important litmus test of all. And there might be other issues that you have to follow on the left or the right, but that's it. I mean, that's it. And if you don't toe the line on that, you get thrown to the wolves.
All right. Let's move on. Marjorie Taylor Greene, one of the candidates for the Republican nomination tomorrow in the 6th District. We're hearing reports that she may decide to bail out of that race and move over to the 14th, where Tom Graves is resigning from a seat, which means perhaps Republicans in Georgia are trying to clear the field for Karen Handel to have a rematch with Lucy McBath.
Yeah, a lot of Karen Handel's Republican opponents have been starting to melt away. You saw Brandon Beach decide that he'd rather stay in the state Senate as transportation chairman. You saw Nicole Rodden say that, you know, her funding is drying up. She was going to give up. You had Donnie Bellena, who self-destructed
and
said a bunch
out
of horrible things. And then you had Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, who's a newcomer who had some tweets that a lot of people saw as very, very questionable. But on the other side, she had a lot of money to self-fund and put in something like $500,000 in seed money. And so for that reason, we were watching her. So it'll be interesting to see how formidable she could be in the 14th, which is one of the most conservative congressional districts in Georgia.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of interesting aspects of that. One of them is, Joel, I'm not sure. I mean, I understand that the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee has endorsed Karen Handel in that race. She's getting some money from Washington. We have not seen the same kind of commitment from national Republican organizations to Karen Handel that we have to the candidates they're backing at some of the other important districts to them. I'm not sure the Republicans have decided they really can beat Karen Handel. I'd like to get your take on it, and then I'll, of course, ask Martha.
Whether or not Karen Handel can beat Lucy McBath.
Right. I apologize.
Well, I think they hope.
Well, sure.
But they realize that if you look at the trend regarding the sixth district regarding the electorate, it's moving to become more diverse. There's greater migration of people of color that are living there now, from the city of Atlanta to the suburbs. And I think they see a trend. They see that in Cobb, and they see that in North DeKalb, and they see in little parts of Fulton that the sixth district is becoming not just purple, but it's becoming more and more blue. And I think they realize she has a lot strong local support. But I think maybe they're just trying to be more judicious regarding the utilization of their dollars, meaning the Congress.
Martha, I base my comment, my observation on the fact that I frankly don't remember what organization it was. There was a spot produced by a Republican organization that condemned the Democrats in swing districts who were supporting impeachment. They put TV money into some of the districts they were targeting, but they didn't put TV money into the sixth here. I think they put up internet ads that attacked Lucy McBath for supporting impeachment. That may not be much evidence, but it does make me wonder a little bit.
Well, I mean, certainly, I think by nature of this being the first reelect, it's most volatile. So there is an opportunity, I think, for Karen Handel to come back in there. I think it's going to be a hard-fought race, just like the 7th District is going to be a hard-fought race. I would disagree that it's blue yet, but I think that the state, you know, is definitely becoming more islandy, right? You know, yeah. You've got the Atlanta metro area that's getting to be blue, and then the rural areas are redder in some ways. So, yes, for the 6th District, I think it's going to be a very hard-fought battle. And, you know, for years, there have been a lot more money for female Democrat candidates than there have been for female Republican candidates. And that has been a challenge. I mean, you know, ever since the inception of Emily's List, which is the most well-known of that group, there have been a lot of money put behind Democrat women, and you see the results in Congress. Now, it's still 20 points lower than the electorate is. It's still only 30 or 37% of the makeup of Congress is of Democrats are female, but it's 8% of the makeup of Congress of Republican females.
Yep. Republicans haven't found an answer. Melita Easters, who's often on this show, just the other day released another list of Democratic pro-choice women who she's putting out there and get attracted.
You're starting to see it on the right. Elise Stefanik, her group, recently endorsed Karen Handel and is starting to put some resources behind.
Okay, thank you.
There's a few out there.
All right. Tamar, you said to me during the break, what? No impeachment? It's a Tamar, it's a rabbit hole. We should let CNN and MSNBC and Fox fight it out. I just want, of course we talk about it when it's in the top of the agenda, but you're not disappointed we're not delving into it and getting ourselves
all worked up,
are you?
I'll let you and Bluestein deal with it tomorrow.
All right. We're out of time for today's show. Tamar Hallerman, Joel Alvarado, Martha Zoller, thank you all so much for a really engaging conversation. We will be back tomorrow. Greg Bluestein will be with us, along with another great panel. And we'll have a lot more issues, as we always do, to discuss on Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. I'll see you then.